I'm Molly Parker. I play Alma Garrett on Deadwood.
And I'm Keith Carradine. I play Wild Bill Hickok.
It's a dirty town.
It's a dirty town. I love this title sequence.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. Well,
yeah, especially this part.
This part. Yeah.
Is that you, Alma?
Yes. Yes, it is. It was so surprising the first time I saw the show with all the CGI in it. And it really, because we shoot, you know, just outside of L.A., where it's deserty and sort of dust bowl, and to sort of see it then with all the trees and... particularly in the first episode, when everyone's coming into town, and you sort of get this sense of the whole place.
It's amazing what's doable now with CGI.
I raise 100.
Back 100.
Jack McCall.
That man's overplaying his hand.
Garrett Dillahunt is playing Jack McCall.
What the fuck I got left?
420, back to you.
This was actually our last poker scene that we shot together. We had done several others in previous episodes, and Garrett was just amazing.
Yeah, he's great.
This guy is such a good actor.
He's actually... we're shooting the second season right now, and he's back as a different character. He's playing a guy called Walcott, who's a very, very wealthy geologist. He looks completely different. It's remarkable.
You were told about that talk. Go eat, Jack.
All right. I thank you for that kindness. You just bought yourself something.
It was so much fun to play Hickok in this piece because David Milch really tried to bring up these little historical, you know, facts. Without making the thing a slave to history, obviously, but that moment with McCall was documented.
Was it?
That Hickok gave him a buck.
Right.
To go eat with after he took all his money. And
it's such a great scene that, and there's this sense of which I think you did so well, Keith, this sort of compassion that Hickok has, while all the while sort of not going to step down to a guy like Jack.
But what are you doing up?
It's cooler working now.
There's Tim.
Sorry you had to listen to them drunken fools before, Mr. Hickok.
I think, like, between this scene and the next morning, suddenly the hardware store is completely built.
They did make a lot of progress.
They really made a lot of progress this night.
Mr. Hickok makes me look for the warrant in your hand.
All right.
Montana okay with you?
The only other nickname I ever had was Sloth.
Don't seem to fit.
Choice was among the seven sins. I guess I got out before the others surfaced.
Camp looks like a good bet.
My wife and boy are with her people in Michigan. I hope I can bring them out soon.
They'll get the Sioux making peace. Pretty
This is a beautiful scene. I really, really like this scene.
Yeah, and what's wonderful, when I look back at this, at these moments, you know, thinking back to when we shot them, mm-hmm. and remembering how much David Milch had to do with
mm-hmm.
with what was underneath everything that we did as actors.
Mm-hmm.
The great benefit of having somebody like him around, when he would come to the mm-hmm. set, which wasn't every time, but when he would, and he would come and talk to us about, he'd almost tell sort of disconnected stories and parables and
yeah.
things that would infuse what you were doing.
Yeah, yeah. He comes often to sort of, I mean, in a way, explain the scene to you, although the scene is written and it's there, and any one of us could understand it and play it, but he brings this other level to it. And although he's not a director, he sort of has the aspects of the best directors that I've worked with, which is a way of explaining an intention to you without ever telling you how to do it.
Exactly.
I mean, sometimes it's very sort of esoteric and out there, and you have to sort of figure out how to translate it into something doable. But there's such richness in what he's able to give you.
It's almost as though I had a couple of experiences where I felt as though just standing and listening to him talk for mm-hmm. 5 minutes, just the nature of what
that.
He talked about. Yeah,
I love that. The hand.
Yeah.
Tight.
Just the nature of what he talked about
yeah.
would then leave me in a certain headspace.
Right. That's what I mean. I mean, that's the best kind of directing,
yeah.
you know? And also, he's living. I came to set and I watched you guys shoot this scene.
What in the fuck is happening to you, Bill?
So you stayed in camp to tuck me in?
If you don't want to prospect, I can put you in charge of that mail route I'm getting.
I'm doing what I want to do.
Bullshit.
Some goddamn.
The blocking in the scene is really good.
Yeah, really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Back
how
to
Alan, back. Alan set this up back to back. Alan Taylor, who directed this episode.
Yeah.
Because he can't be something he tries to be every goddamn day without once getting to dinner time and not fucking it up.
Now that speech, that little mini monologue there is so classic Milch.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I read that thing 150 times.
Yeah.
You know, because I really wanted to get it right
yeah.
in terms of the intention, you know, and it's just the David has a way of assembling syntax in
yeah.
such an interesting way, and it is at once almost kind of Shakespearean
mm-hmm.
and quintessentially American period all at the same time.
Yeah, it's really hard to do sometimes.
It's hard.
I mean, this, yeah, that scene really breaks my heart. Yeah, he writes in this way that the thoughts start and then they skip ahead and then they come back.
Second guess. If you wanted to explain why I'm to buy the dude out of a worthless claim, I'd surely listen.
Bill Sanderson.
Jesus Christ.
What is it?
The dude must have had some kind of accident.
Uh-oh.
I've worked with Sanderson a number of times over the years.
With Bill, yeah?
Yeah.
Looks dead, don't he?
Yes.
He's so funny.
He's one of the funniest human beings on the
Isn't
planet.
Isn't he?
And you think back to what he used to do on the Newhart show, and then you see him here.
I know.
In this context.
I know.
And he's so good.
We were watching him the other day on set, and David just looked at me and said, he's wonderful. He's just so wonderful.
Yeah. And I remember him, that wonderful scene that he had in Blade Runner.
Mm.
Go back and look at that sometime.
Yeah, I will.
I mean, his body of work is amazing. There you are, Molly.
Yeah, in my 90.
In your 90.
Hi in my 90. Blood. Look at the blood on his hat, on his hand. So there was this idea that I'd been sitting up all night getting high, knowing somehow that this was coming.
About what happened at this camp, let alone send the Pinkertons out. And 20,000 is a lot of money.
Let me tell you several things, E.P. First,
$20,000 is a lot of money. Second, it's my fucking money. Third, the widow being a dope fiend might let matters rest. But fourth, well, this camp has a lot more to offer me than $20,000 as long as I don't get killed by the fucking Pinkertons. Why take the chance?
Why is it I have no trouble talking over my own work, but I have a really hard time talking through, you know, watching these guys?
It's true. Well, you sort of an element of respecting what other people are doing. Here's my dead husband.
Now, I was fascinated, Molly, when I saw you do this.
Mm.
This is an extraordinary moment to me because this is your husband.
Yeah.
And it's almost as though you're in shock and sort of macabrely fascinated all at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, partly I'm in my bare feet in the mud beside a donkey that was about to kick me in the head any second. Here I am bending down, you know, and all I'm thinking is like, I hope that donkey doesn't fucking kick me. But, you know, there was this thing that David and I were working on, which is that this woman is a junkie. She's a laudanum addict, which was, you know, opium in alcohol, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that opium does, which is different than other drugs, is it sort of gives you visions. And there was sort of this idea that she knew this was coming, and she sort of foresaw it, and yet didn't stop him. And in general, I wanted to sort of feel like this was the first time this woman had ever been outside.
Well, plus, when you think about this moment in time, this moment in societal time, for a woman to be outdoors in her nightgown.
In her bare feet. Never, ever done.
Completely scandalous.
And Alma, in her right mind, would never have done it. But there is an element of Alma that is, of course, you know, but Tim can take his shirt off.
Yes, well. And it's required to.
And you really, and it's who really minds. It's not the worst thing that's ever happened.
You think he smells the go?
Nah. EB's too busy sniffing what he can steal being go between.
I had a great time being on the set with McShane.
Mm-hmm.
When I was there, my short-lived tenure in Deadwood. He's a classic Brit, you know.
We have actually still never done a scene together.
You haven't worked with Ian yet?
We're halfway through the second season.
Well, I'm sure you'll get one eventually, and you'll enjoy that. But the best part of it was just hanging out with him, because he's got 1,000 jokes. And I love trading the jokes.
He's funny, and his work is so specific and so good. Here we have Brad Dourif. I like this shot a lot.
I know Al wants her leaving here with as least of a sour taste in her mouth as possible, Doc.
Well, when you expect her husband's death to be sour on her tongue, no matter how it happened.
Questions whether it's fate she blames or people in the camp. What are you looking for?
Morning, Seth.
I thought your husband did an excellent job, by the way, of being dead there.
You know, he was really wonderful, Tim Amundsen. He's I loved working with him, and then, but he'd done all this stuff, of course, with in other scenes that I wasn't in that I didn't see until we saw the whole thing, and he was just great. The character was such a difficult kind of combination of this. You know, this sort of fool, this dandy. But if that's all he was, then we wouldn't have cared about him or about Alma, you know. And so it was a fine line. He was funny, too.
I've brought the doctor.
Put my clothes on, finally. I love that. We had some, you know, the first sort of half of, well, sort of all along, Alma and Billy's character are at each other.
It's a very special relationship that you two have, I must say. Skull fractures consistent with that. Not been wounded by bullets. In the subsequent episode, when he's in the chess match over the you know, the laundry and the whether you're taking the opium or not. And,
yeah. No, it's great. And I hate him so much that we're almost about to do a thing where I decide I'm going to buy the hotel just so I can throw him out on the street. And then Ellsworth convinces me, you know, like, you don't really want to buy this hotel. I'm like, oh, all right. But I just want to sort of see him suffer. Such a weasel.
Perhaps you don't feel at such perfect liberty to opine on my husband's case as you did on mine.
There we have some more of that.
Yes.
Milchian.
Inimitable Milch.
Yeah.
Do other men?
I do not know how your husband's skull got caved in. You're a bright woman, aren't you? You must have gone through hell here.
A little old dope dealer.
Push him in. I mean, that was the thing, though, about... I mean, there were... This was not uncommon. There were so many women, particularly of almost class and social standing, who were addicted to laudanum because it was given by doctors for...
It was kind of a cure-all, wasn't it?
It was a cure-all. Particularly for, you know, women... problems, for migraines, any kind of
for migraines or the monthlies or whatever female ailment. Yeah.
And so the pain begins. Oh no, my drugs, what have I done?
Oh, and here, all this time I thought you were crying over your husband.
I know, that's what everyone thinks, but no.
Once I've determined my plans.
You know, these Victorian necklines, they really, they choke you.
Thank you.
It's amazing. I mean, women at that time, they couldn't imagine the freedom we have now. I mean, they couldn't even imagine what it would feel like to wear what I'm allowed to wear, you know.
To not be trussed up.
Trussed and tied and collar to your, you know, chin and... I love these costumes. They're so beautiful.
I'm overcome with remorse, Mrs. Garrett, that I failed to change the course of events.
Oh, William.
I love the way he talks.
If I your situation in any way, I renew my offer at $12,000. I know it won't bring him back.
No. We both know that. You'll have your answer shortly.
All right, madam.
Janie Bryant, Catherine Jane Bryant, is our costume designer, and she's incredible. She draws all these things. She paints them and then has them made and makes them. This shirt I have on is an original piece. It was 150 years old.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, Robin.
Robin Weigert.
Who's asking?
This is like a meeting of the most two opposite women you could find, right?
Which
David just loves. It's like, you know, put these women together who really don't even speak the same language.
My husband had tried to engage Mr. Hickok just before his death, and I thought, though they hadn't come to terms, perhaps Mr. Hickok would be willing to advise me on my current situation.
I remember that's a piece that I think works in the end, but I remember reading it and, you know, I come and I knock on the door and say, my husband's just died. I'm sorry to bother you. My husband's just died under mysterious circumstances. You know, and it's like, who are you?
I'm sorry about your husband.
May I ask your name?
Jane.
Thank you, Jane.
Well, it's interesting to see these two women. I mean, obviously, you're a very refined, upper-class, Eastern...
Victorian, like, uptight.
Proper... Yeah.
Drug addict.
Drug addict, yes. A proper drug addict.
But, you know, but it was, I mean, there was no real... There wasn't a lot of sort of consciousness around addiction. So, I mean, look, everyone's just drinking all the time. Yep. And, you know, and it's not... so different from now, and she wouldn't have been looked down upon in society for taking drugs.
Oh,
you
no,
know?
Sure.
It was just what it was just fine. It was what was done, and it's really through her own experience that she comes to quit. What's his idea of routine? Meaning that I think what is offered to her in this camp is once her husband has died, although I don't think she's conscious of it, is that she can sort of be born again and be a real person.
Mm-hmm.
Kim Dickens. Sweet Kim Dickens. She's so great.
Now, here's Mr. Cramed.
Mm-hmm.
Which name, when I first read it, I thought, where the hell did Milch come up with that name?
Who knows?
Cy Tolliver. Name's Cramed. I'd like a room, I'd like exclusive use of a safe, and I'd like to shoot some dice.
I'd like to think this first day of a long friendship, Mr. Crane. We'll get you a room. If you'll step into my office, we'll meet your needs for a safe. Help you with your luggage.
Suitcases go to the room.
Expect you'll keep the police.
Keep what you expect of yourself, and you'll improve our chances at that friendship.
It's amazing to do this show, and done some good work on this, and you're doing such sort of huge stories, and yet so is everyone. Like, the density of this particular episode,
mm-hmm.
when I first saw it, I couldn't believe what he fit into 1 hour.
Yeah, it's kind of it's
an enormous amount of story telling to fit into an hour.
Sure. Signal when ready, Commander.
If I didn't make my point, I'd like to get something fucking working.
Sure, Andy.
One of the things that impresses me when I go back and look at this stuff as well is how many layers there are.
Mm-hmm.
Like he spent 3 weeks on a wagon?
I'm optimistic, Al. And she's promised a prompt reply.
I thought she'd say yes on the spot.
Ooh. Ooh, Ian.
Ian,
look at that stare.
He is such a cobra, man.
Oh, isn't he? He is like a cobra.
Yeah. He's just brilliant.
Yeah.
One simple fucking instruction. She will take the 12, Al, and be happy to get it. And all you'll have to decide is how much of the 8 you save should go to me.
You're incorrigible.
I do my best.
Yeah, I'll go weigh the 12. She says yes, there should be something in this for you.
Hint at the amount.
Don't get ahead of yourself, E.B. When she signs a bill of sale, you come back here and sign it over to me.
It is your 12, after all.
Once all that's done, you should walk out of here with 2,000.
Fair recompense.
For saving me money in spite of myself.
I suggested to my husband just last night that we should try to view our time here as one experience bought at a single price. Even now he's murdered, I feel that.
One of the things about working on this show, and I think, well, apparently working with David in general is sort of, I mean, we had a full script or close to a full script for this episode, but after that, by the next episode, we sort of had less and less, and soon you sort of are getting the pages the day before, which is the way that David works, and I think it's the only way he can work. And
as he said, he likes to work close to the bone.
Yeah. Well, in many ways, it actually is great as an actor because it forces you to really play the moment. I mean, you don't know what's coming. All you have is sort of that one particular scene.
Yeah.
But there is a challenge with this kind of language to learn lines at the last second.
Mm-hmm.
It's this saloon operator you think is pulling the strings.
Al Swearingen, it was...
But it's so great. The stuff's so great. You just want all the time in the world to luxuriate in it, because it's
Well, and I must say that of all of the sort of television projects I've been a part of, HBO gives you the time. You really actually...
We do.
You can take the time to get it right.
We are so lucky. I mean, they really spend the time.
And by this point in my tenure with the show, that the language that you're talking about, you know, it's taken on a rhythm of its own.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we were all fairly accustomed to to the convention of speech that David brought to this environment.
Jeffrey Jones. It's a wonderful costume. I mean, I've seen the pictures of Hickok.
Yeah, as far as I know, apart from the film that Jeff Bridges did with Walter Hill, this is the first time Hickok's been presented, you know, at all accurately.
Is this, and the one photo I saw, I mean, this costume is really similar to what he wore. It's
yes.
Exact, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how'd they take to the craps game?
Let chimps hit their first fire.
Yeah, these gunfighters, they were kind of the rock stars of the era.
Right.
And they had a great sense of theatricality about them. All of the stuff that I read about Hickok and others like him who were, you know, sort of Dapper Dans, you know,
right.
they would put on this, they would adopt this mode of dress that was a statement in itself, because so much of what they did and the way they lived their lives was about intimidation.
Right.
And if you presented yourself in a way that would be intimidating to a potential adversary, you had a better shot at surviving,
right.
You know, whatever.
Right, or not having to get into a conflict.
Or not having to even get into a fight,
right.
Yeah.
Which is so...
In the last few days.
The idea if a guy would dress that fancy,
right.
Well, he better be a badass
to get
away with dressing like
sure.
That.
Sure,
right?
And the red sash you have coming up. I mean, it is really dramatic. But that's interesting, because I think that the other part of the language that we haven't talked about, but the cursing in the show also has to do with that intimidation as to not have to get into...
That's right.
Get into conflict.
Particularly in this community, which was so utterly lawless.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the fact is, if you look at somebody cross-eyed, they could shoot you.
And drunk.
Without
and,
any, you know, and drunk.
You know, and guns everywhere, and money everywhere.
The idea that if you presented yourself with enough grit,
right,
that nobody would mess with you,
right.
And part of that grit was how you spoke.
Absolutely.
So if you laced enough profanity into your speech,
right,
then you would be presenting yourself as someone to be feared.
Sure. I mean, that's Swearingen's whole thing. Although he is a scary guy,
he's
you know. I mean, he'll kill someone when he has to, but or when he does enough to sort of keep the fear in the people who work for him.
This was fun to do. This was the only scene I got to play with Ian.
Mm.
I got a healthy operation here, and I didn't build it brooding on the right and wrong of things. And I do not need the Pinkertons descending like locusts. So I bend over for the tenderfoot cocksucker. Reconnoiter your claim fully, I say. And then, if you're still unhappy, I will give you your fucking money back. And the tenderfoot agrees, just as he's finishing his reconnoiter. Cocksucker falls to his death, pure fucking accident, but up jumps the widow in righteous fucking indignation. Wants the doctor to examine him for murder wounds.
Now, Keith,
mm-hmm.
Is yeah. That really your mustache?
Oh, yeah, that's mine. That was the actual... I was so happy to be able to have the time to grow my own mustache.
Yeah.
And not have to glue the fucking thing on
yeah.
Every day. It was... I've glued on plenty of facial hair in my
right.
Life, you know. It's no fun.
No, they look good.
And 9 times out of 10, you wind up, we as actors, we get the job 3 days before it starts filming, you
right.
Know. Well, okay, then we'll choose you.
Right.
And you have, you know, no time to prepare, no time to even think. So to actually know that this was coming.
Right.
And be able to grow my own tree under my nose was...
we had a long time, well, a number of months, 8 months or 9 months between the pilot and when we shot the second episode, so.
See, now there's a shot where you can see the mustache is real, because the fake ones, if you're paying attention, you'll see that little bit of
the
glisten.
Edge. Mm-hmm.
You'll see a little shine underneath the hairs from the glue underneath.
Yeah. Right.
That's a dead giveaway. The hair, however.
You really see your blue eyes in that shot, too.
Yes, my fake blue
your
eyes.
Your fake blue eyes.
Yeah. Yeah, Hickok was known for his blue eyes, which I was not born with, but hey. The contact lenses actually added a lot to my performance, because basically my eyes hurt all the time.
Mm.
You know?
No, and it's so dirty and dry out there. I mean, it looks muddy, but really where we shoot, it's so dry and hot and dusty. I'm sure it's bad. Here's a scene about two people who are trying to communicate and don't speak any of the same language.
He stole off on me.
I had to come in here to look out for Will.
I love the feathers in
yeah.
Jane's hat. You
yeah.
know, these feathers in her cap. They have this sort of splash of her own sort of dramaticism. Is that a word, dramaticism?
I liked it. I'm not sure if it's a real word or not, but.
May I commission you?
Some would question my fitness on either count, but I'll guarantee you I'm not competent. I do know someone I trust to ask.
Please do.
Name's Bullock. I'll go talk to him now.
Now, Hickok going to talk to Bullock about helping me out really gets used for a long time. You know, it sort of becomes this excuse of why he and I end up getting to spend a lot of time together.
Right.
It's like, and he even says when his wife comes in the first episode. But I promised
Bill Hickok.
I promised Bill I'd take care of her.
I promised Bill I'd sleep with her for 7.
So thanks.
Oh, yeah, no problem. Ah, yes, Hickok the Enabler.
Right.
Well, it was interesting throughout this episode and throughout the three episodes that I did, all of the research indicated that Hickok was actually, he had a sense of his own end coming.
Right.
He had a prescience about it. He actually said to someone at one point that he had visions of his own death.
Really?
Yeah. And it's documented. It's historical fact.
Mm-hmm.
So, in talking with David about it, there was a sense always of Hickok's kind of resignedness,
mm-hmm.
even inviting it to come, that he had a sense of having really lived his full life.
Right.
That his life, that there was nothing left for him to do.
Right, right,
that
right.
The era of people like him was ending.
Right.
And that there was a sense of his time having passed, and that living beyond that passage of his time would be unnecessary.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, and maybe even kind of boring. And he was also, apparently, his vision was going.
Right.
Which apparently was due to, he had syphilis, and it was advancing,
right.
And it was causing him trouble with his eyes. And,
right, right.
And
so physically, he was...
Yeah. And everything else that I read about him was that he was courtly, was that he was well-mannered with the ladies.
Mm-hmm,
he liked kids.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't a boor.
Right.
You know, but...
And there seemed to be something that you and David were exploring around his celebrity.
Yes. Well, we looked at that.
Because he was very famous.
He was very famous, and we had that episode, in the previous episode to this one, where he has that encounter in the street.
Right.
With a fan.
Right, right.
And we've heard about, you know, these experiences that celebrities have in the modern world. Right now in our own time, and the idea of that not being new,
right.
I thought was so great.
Right.
I can't worry about about his plans as far as where he decides to gamble elsewhere, or this new joint overwhelms the camp.
We made no agreement.
Leon Rippey.
Nice sign.
I worked on Leon's first movie.
Did you?
Did a miniseries down in South Carolina. Chester, South Carolina was where we shot it. And Leon came down there and he was an extra.
Oh, really?
And that was when he decided he wanted to be an actor.
Oh, wow.
Now, this moment with Garrett just kills me.
Yeah.
He tries to... he tries to make reference to...
You believe that because you're a walking fucking cunt.
Right.
This one. And he just can't get it right.
Can't find it at all.
Give me a buck then, Lou. Send me off for a meal.
Give me a buck.
Give me a buck. See what part of you get shot. Because I possess a fucking gun that I didn't bet.
I'll pay you $5 for that gun sight unseen. Because what you need, Jack, is a stake to make you come back. That'll get you out of this brown study you're in.
Brown study.
See, you know, that's classic Milch.
That is so classic. It's an incredible makeup job that that John Rizzo did on him.
Yeah.
I mean, Garrett's a really good-looking man.
Yeah, and he came up with that notion of putting the stuff in half his nose and really making his face kind of lopsided.
Yeah. Well, and he did, Jack McCall did have a lazy eye, is that right?
Yeah.
That's my favorite.
Oh, double fucking solitaire.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
You know, Leon's just so great.
I'd have to bring someone from Montana. Would the widow give it that much time?
Yeah, she would. She don't want to be stupid or fool. She wants to stand up for her husband better than he stood up for himself. Not that she ought to stick around.
As far as that goes, she could sign a proxy.
There's her hunting in it. And what that saloon keeper gave me, if you'd want to take it on.
All right.
A lot of those kind of moments, you know, where there's a couple things going on.
Yeah.
You know, there's this going on. There's Jack McCall in the background.
Trust ain't his long suit. She ought to be looking for a wagon.
Thanks for the favor, Montana.
Sure.
You know,
the notion of these two guys being kind of discovering a sort of father-son relationship was one of the things that David talked a lot about when Tim and I were doing our scenes together, that there was this sort of sense of Hickok recognizing a kindred spirit and someone who he could sort of leave his job to in
life. And who also may be haunted by similar things, you know.
Exactly.
I think it's something that David did so well and I think was shocking to a lot of people. When Hickok dies, I mean, when the show was airing, so many people called me. I mean, they couldn't believe it. They thought he was going to be around forever.
Yeah.
And there was this kind of invitation to love him and care about him. And it was, you know, Hickok was only in Deadwood for, 10 days before
he was there.
He died.
Historically, he was there for 10 days before he was shot in the head, yeah.
But it lays, for the show, and I think for the long term of the show, his character laid this sort of foundation for Tim's character and for my character to live into. You know, David talked to both of us, I think, a lot of sort of like the legacy that Hickok leaves is this thing that we can live into in terms of the kind of people that we decide to become, that these characters decide to become.
I'd say that's water under the bridge.
And I'd say Hickok has to die if I have to kill him myself.
Jesus, Al, Jesus, with all that's going on? I mean, how would it sit with the widow, for one thing? How would that dispose her toward us?
Let me pose you a question, E.B., you fucking cunt. Someone comes at you, what are you supposed to do about it?
I love this.
And I'll pose...
look at what he does with his hand. Watch, Bill.
Professional colleague has a mistaken impression of
who's coming at like, what is that? It's incredible.
He's just so brilliant.
Yeah.
You don't think he's coming at me?
I don't think Hickok's coming at you, Al. No, I don't. I think you're a man with so many different responses.
One of the things that Milch's sense of language does for me as an audience member, as a viewer, mm-hmm. you know, is it's just, I find it so engrossing.
Mm.
You have to really listen.
You have to really
listen.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of material that this stuff holds up. You can watch this 100 times and you'll see a different show every time you watch it. Because it's so rich. And, you know, to be doing this kind of material in the face mm-hmm. of where, you know, most entertainment is going. And this is.
It's really what's so great about doing this show on HBO. I mean, I can't imagine another situation where we could go as far as we go, not just with the violence or the swearing, but with the language, with the complexity of the characters, you know? Because you have to watch each episode. I mean, you don't know.
Yeah.
Each one depends on the last. You have to see the one before. I mean, there's only 12, so it's not like it's. But it's not a kind of one-off show that you can tune into any time and understand what's going on.
Now, there's another thing that I find really such a relief about the way this whole thing is presented is there's no music.
Right.
The music is so sparingly used.
Right. Right.
And one of my favorite things about flipping channels and finding an old movie is how little they used music.
Right.
You know, 30, 40 years ago to try and tell an audience what to feel.
Mm-hmm.
The audience was left to, you know, discover for themselves mm-hmm. through the performances and the nature of character and what's unfolding in the story. You know, it makes you feel how it makes you feel. You don't need a soundtrack
right.
of music to tell you what to feel. And in this episode, when it gets to the denouement in this right. particular episode, the use of the music is so perfect.
Yes, yes, yes.
Girls wanting to give you a bath?
I fell right the hell to sleep.
You ready to meet some strange?
Tell you the truth, Johnny, I'm feeling out of sorts.
Well, you had a long trip. And I've heard worse confessions.
That's the gospel truth. I hope you'll keep to yourself.
Yeah, sure I will, Andy.
I feel fucking unwell myself.
Since there's a smallpox coming to town, it's the beginning of it, which is sort of setting up a storyline for sort of the next couple of episodes, you know?
It's fascinating. When you think about all the stuff that is laced together in this episode...
Isn't it? I mean, it's... among all of them, it's one of the densest hours of television I've ever seen.
$50 an issue.
Well,
Powers Booth and Ricky Jay.
Purchase your advertisement in an amount of space wildly incommensurate with the accompanying articles.
And see, I never heard that word in my life.
That's his trade, Si. He's a wordsmith.
See, he's fascinated with language, David. He yeah. talks about it. It's the it's what's underlying a lot of, you know,
yeah.
communication, who can understand who,
yes.
Different class.
I haven't shot the crap since.
Shot
the crap, you know.
If you'll keep my secret, sir. No, I've never shot them.
Shot them.
Yeah.
I've never shot the craps.
Maybe that would make an article. A man... I feel almost duty bound to remonstrate you, sir.
3 months in advance, Eddie. 50 an issue.
Let's see the man in the cage.
Seriously? Don't let him take your money, Mr. Merrick, while he's teaching you this game. Who did you give to Andy?
Nobody. He's poorly.
Does he need a doctor?
Maybe he does.
God damn it. I told you I didn't like the way he looked. Stand outside, roommate. No one in or out. Get the doc. Tell him someone fell.
Every time that guy walks up with the white hair, I think of Lee Marvin in Paint Your Wagon. I remember this scene.
Me too.
May I ask, ma'am, when you'd expect to leave the camp?
I remember shooting this scene.
Bullock
is honorable. At least six different ways,
I think we did. I think we did.
You know the sound of thunder, don't you, Mrs. Garrett?
Here it comes.
Of course.
Can you imagine that sound if I ask you to?
That's like a painting, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, this moment here, this moment Alan Taylor shot at least six different ways.
Yeah.
He couldn't make up his mind.
No, and I think...
Because the language is so specific.
Yeah.
I was really curious to see how he was going to wind up cutting it. The fact that he chose this one, because he had so many different...
I really like this one. I think that was the last one we did.
Was it?
Yeah. Or close to the last.
Very good luck to you.
Thank you for all your help.
It's really hard, I think, with these sort of, these sort of climactic moments between characters, because you don't know how. I think it's hard for the director to know sort of how far you can go until you see everything else cut together, you know, and what's really needed.
Sure.
Thanks for coming, Doc.
Boss said someone fell.
Roommate.
See, still no music. Mm-hmm. I love that. Because I'm big into the music and how being used properly. And one of my pet peeves has always been too much music in movies.
Right.
It's like there's this constant soundtrack, you know.
Well, you start to feel manipulated.
Absolutely.
You know, you feel...
Well, it gets to the point where you don't even notice the music is there anymore.
Insulted. This is Bree Wall. She plays Sophia, who you guys have rescued, and then I come to adopt, and I have since done many, many, many scenes with Bree.
Have you?
She's so great.
Anyways, how'd it go with Bullock?
He'll help the widow.
Good for him. Good for you.
Now, this was pure Milch right here.
Right.
He said, tickle her.
Right.
He told me specifically do that. He said at that point. So this whole moment of softness, you know, amongst these people who are living in such a hard world.
Mm-hmm.
And I love what Robin does, you know, her movement back and forth between the toughness of you know, Jane the Hellion and this tender, nurturing woman, you know, with this little girl.
Mm-hmm.
And the way she's kind of, you know, she's always different around Hickok than she is around everybody else.
Sure.
And this moment of goodbye here.
Yeah.
You know, all of these foreshadowings that were designed into this piece. The fact that Hickok's writing this letter to his wife. He wrote several times and basically lied to her.
Right.
Telling her how, you know, hard he was working. He was out there swinging a pick and mining, and he never did any of that. I mean, he drank and gambled the whole time he was there.
Right.
But, you know, had this kind side where he wanted to try and make this woman believe that he was actually, you know, working towards their future.
And at one point, wasn't there... There was a voiceover, over this.
We had designed a voiceover where I actually, you hear me speaking the words that I've just written to my wife. Now, the red sash here was, this is also by design. Get her, Ian. Get after it. Attaboy.
Was the sash, was...
To quote Jack Warden from Shampoo, now that's what I call fucking. There was, in fact, Hickok wore that red sash a few years before.
Oh, yes.
So it had been a part of his,
his
costume,
wardrobe,
you know, the way he presented himself.
I don't know what he landed on.
And the idea of using that at this point in the story.
Yeah,
and the notion that he's, in fact, he's kind of dressing
for his death.
For his own death.
Yeah.
He's anticipating it. He's inviting it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He's encouraging it, in a way.
And is it true that I mean, he always sat with his back to the wall, did he?
Yes.
Not?
He would always sit with his back to the wall. And the story is that when he walked into this card game, there was somebody sitting in his customary chair.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually had a conversation with him. A guy said, oh, does it really matter to you, Bill? You know, what are you afraid of, you know?
And
he sort of reluctantly went, well, okay. But we kind of took it a step further here. He walks into the game.
Mm-hmm.
Notices that his back is going to be to the door and accepts it. It's kind of a classic moment of this guy choosing almost to the time and place.
Right, right.
How he was going to check out.
Right.
So it's subtle, but you see him step up to the chair, notice the physical situation, and then just accept it and sit down.
Mm-hmm.
Boys, how's it going?
My father was the best company from the time I was ever so little. Problems or difficulties or even sadness, no such thing. Not permitted. The evening I was presented to society, I found out later he'd been able to attend only by physically fleeing some...
Here you are again, Molly, with this wonderful... language.
Alma takes her a long time to say what she means sometimes.
Well, and especially when you're talking to Jane.
Yeah.
You know?
Father whispered to me, "Darling, I can never repay you for what you were about to do, but I can repay everyone else." So we learn how Alma got here, that her father was a gambler and a con man, really, and in an enormous amount of debt. And I said, maybe he'll die. And she loved her father very much, and so she married this man to get him out of debt.
That was pretty good there, Ian.
Hopped right off.
I mean... You know, the basic time frame that we just went through, he was banging away like that for about 6 minutes. That's pretty good.
She looks a little tired. Paula.
Wonder if he took any breaks in there.
Paula Malcolmson, who plays Trixie. See, now here, this is what I mean.
Oh, so, this is the next day.
This is the next day. The hardware store is like fully built.
Ah, well.
But
it's the movies. Reality is no excuse. They're working very
Bullock
hard.
Bullock is a hard worker.
He's a very hard worker. And very proficient as well. I wanted to make sure that you understood that he saw it coming.
Right. Oh.
God damn you!
The interesting thing was is that when we shot it, what I did was at that moment where I look up, and then
here comes the music.
And now the music starts.
And it's after the climax.
Yeah.
It's after, you know?
And it just slowly builds out.
Yeah. Because although it's about Hickok's death, it's about what he does to the entire town.
Yeah.
It's about Deadwood. I mean, this show...
It's a cosmic shift in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just chilling. This music, it gives me the shivers now when I hear it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just... it's so brilliantly executed. Then you see Jane get an inkling of what's happening. Something's going on. This is so beautifully done because nobody's really sure what's happened, but there is this sense among everyone that something climactic has taken place. Look at you two.
Well, one of the things about playing Alma is you do a lot of window acting. I mean, finally this year I sort of get out of this room, but really I looked out that window a lot. So that's also the point at which Jane leaves me with the girl.
Yes.
Because she doesn't return. Ugh.
Oh, dear Robin. I find her work in this show to be so completely astounding. I just, for, you know.
She's so wonderful.
That's my old pal, Peter Jason.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's such an outrageous image, you know, of this man coming to town with a severed head. Which sort of links back to Swearengen had said that he would pay anyone $50 for every decapitated head they brought back, but that it happens in that moment.
Now they cut the music, see?
Mm-hmm.
It's just so smart. And there you have it, ladies and gentlemen.
It's
yet another cheerful episode of Deadwood. Brought to you by your friendly...
It's, you know, it all, I mean, I'm so moved by watching that again. It's been a while since I've seen it, but...
That's a hell of an hour of TV, boy.
Yeah.
I'll tell you. I'm proud to be a part of that, Molly, and I'm proud to have been there with you.
Thank you. Me too.
And next time I see Ian, I'm really going to have to slap him on the back and tell him what a good job he did there.
Yeah.
In that scene with Trixie.
Oh, stop.
That's some of the best acting I've ever seen.
We should just sign off now. I think it's over. We don't need to talk about this anymore. Okay, Keith. Nice talking to you.
You too. Good to see you.
Bye.